I came to believe that Atlanta was a city defined by Black hope and white pragmatism. And these two mayors embodied that, Black hope and white pragmatism. The Black hope essentially centered at on the West Side, those wonderful six colleges at the Atlanta University Center, most prominently Morehouse College and Spelman College. You know, Atlanta, because of those colleges, had a better educated, better employed Black population than any city in America, with the possible exception of Washington, D.C., though most of the jobs in Washington, I think, are federal jobs. On Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, those jobs were more entrepreneurial in spirit, business and law and medicine. You know, Ivan Allen Jr., who was mayor of Atlanta in the 1960s during its most racially tumultuous time, when Atlanta had to decide what kind of a city it was going to become. And the 1961 mayor's race was really Atlanta's moment of truth, when Ivan Allen ran against the segregationist Lester Maddox. And Maddox won the white vote in 1961. And if not for the Black vote, nearly all of those votes going to Ivan Allen Jr., Ivan Allen Jr. wouldn't have won. Ivan Allen Jr. saw himself as a pragmatist. He saw himself as, you know, having been raised in Atlanta's elite quarters in the business community. He was had a sense of noblesse oblige, giving back to the community in various ways, as his father, Ivan Allen Sr., had done. And I think he would have said that what he was most proud of was the Atlanta skyline. The Atlanta skyline business transformed in the 1960s. If you look at a photograph of the Atlanta skyline before Ivan Allen took office, you know, going back to 1961, and after he left office at the end of the 60s, it looks like Oz has risen from the earth. It's a totally transformed city. I think he was very proud that he had brought professional sports to Atlanta. The Falcons, the Braves, the Hawks, all came because of Ivan Allen. With Maynard Jackson, I think he would say he was very proud of the fact that that airport in Atlanta was rebuilt on time and under budget, as he liked to say, during his administration. And you know the old saw that before you go to heaven, you have to change planes in Atlanta. Well, that airport has had a systemic effect on Atlanta's life. Maynard Jackson would also talk about that affirmative action piece, the minority involvement in all municipal contracts, that he was going to reshape Atlanta, bring a fairness to it that had not existed in its entire history. And he was enormously proud of that. I think Maynard also, as I say, spoke for history. In his oratory, he was, you know, hearkening back to Terminus virtually. And the name of Atlanta when it was originally founded as a railroad hub. And he was, you know, Atlanta has been fortunate with its mayors, Maynard Jackson and Ivan Allen and Bill Hartsfield, who was a municipal magician. Hartsfield's was sort of Atlanta's version of Fiorello LaGuardia. He was there for a very long time, two decades and more. And he had this Houdini-like skill, this ability to give Black Atlantans a sense of progress while at the same time reassuring whites that he was holding the line. That's a tightrope to walk, and Hartsfield did it exquisitely. And so both these mayors were defining. I think Ivan Allen becomes the bridge from the old South to the new. And when he gets to the distant shore, there stands Maynard Jackson waiting to take Atlanta into the modern era.
Welcome to the Atlanta Legacy Makers Podcast. I'm Floyd Hall here at the Atlanta History Center. This episode corresponds to the epilogue section of the Gary M. Pomerantz book, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, A Saga of Race and Family. You heard Gary's voice in the open, revealing some backstory on writing the book. In this episode, we reflect on legacy and family with some perspective from Ivan Allen Jr.'s grandson, Bo Allen, and Maynard Jackson's widow, Valerie Jackson. The Atlanta History Center is one of the few places where you can engage with Atlanta's past and present and connect with many of the people, places, and events that we learn about in Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn. So it seemed like an appropriate place for us to visit for this epilogue episode. With that in mind, let's jump right into our featured conversations, starting it off with Bo Allen.
Bo Allen, I'm Ivan Allen Jr.'s youngest grandson, in my early 30s, with a beautiful wife and two kids. Proud to call Atlanta home. Certainly still making my way in the world, but excited to be with you today.
Bo, thank you for that. Let's start with, of course, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn. So I guess in this book, for me as someone who has come to the text much later after it was written, but what I gained from it is that we get a really good understanding of how family is tied to the city of Atlanta, and in particular, your family is tied to the city of Atlanta. So I guess starting there, how do you connect Atlanta and your family in your heart, in your mind?
Yeah. Absolutely. Great question. Really, in my mind, the two are inseparable. I grew up learning about the incredible achievements of Atlanta's iconic civil rights leaders, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Congressman Lewis, Ambassador Young, and their leadership positioning Atlanta as the international city that it has become today. My family and I've always admired their achievements, and I have the great benefit of having many generations before me call it Atlanta home. So I'm incredibly fortunate to be able to appreciate how strong the common bond and affinity for our hometown are across our city. I personally spent 7 years in New York City before returning home a few years ago to start a family of my own with my wife Allison, also an Atlanta native. And I think spending that time away while frequently visiting and keeping a pulse on business and political activity here gave me an even stronger appreciation for the draw that I have towards our city. My family and I have always supported and promoted economic activity and certainly societal progress here in Atlanta and in Georgia. And I think it's just so exciting to see the thriving commercial and entrepreneurial and social activity here. And you know, I think Atlanta continues to lead on the global stage. And I think it's never been a stronger or better place to live.
Well, Bo, I think this book really highlights a few different approaches to being mayor of Atlanta. I think the mayors that we see in this book handle it differently. The times were different for each of these mayors. So I think that plays a role into it as well. But from you, I guess, knowing the history of Atlanta, how you do, what do you get from, I guess, the responsibility or the obligation that is required of anyone, I guess, holding the seat or the office of mayor of Atlanta?
Yeah, I think the number one thing a mayor has to do is be really a uniting force for good to advance the interests of all Atlanta residents. And it's an interesting time to have that question posed. And I really have to commend the current mayor for her strong leadership in recent months. She has really continued and I think even enhanced the legacy of Atlanta mayors who brought together so many different constituencies in so many different eras in the common goal of ensuring that Atlanta is the best place and it can be, and that it continues to attract folks from all over the world to come live, work, and play here. I think she and other Atlanta mayors before her have really embraced the strength of Atlanta's diverse community and really leveraged that as a as a key asset and kind of leverage that for the collective benefit and advancement of our city. And I think Atlanta just continues to be a terrific destination and draw for so many different types of people doing so many different types of things. And I think it's a real differentiator that Atlanta has kind of versus other metro areas across the U.S. And I think our mayors have recognized that strength and use it to continue to keep moving the city forward.
Do you have a favorite Ivan Allen Jr. story? I know this may be a little unfair, but, you know, whether it be from a family perspective or either from a mayoral perspective, what's your favorite story?
Yeah, well, I might kind of take the liberty of sharing a few thoughts here. So I am the youngest of seven Allen grandchildren, and I personally spent a lot of time with them, kind of really quality time on the golf course prior to his passing in 2003, which was when I was in high school. But we have a pretty large family, at least in my view, and I think my bride's view, and he certainly rejoiced in family gatherings around the holidays, and we just have some great traditions that he and my grandmother started and that have carried on to this day, which is so exciting to see. I think a lot of what people don't necessarily appreciate about Grandpa, as we call him, was the strength of his relationship and the partnership with my grandmother, Louise. She was really the rock of our family, and certainly to him, she raised my dad, Beaumont, the youngest of three boys, while my grandfather was in office. Certainly a turbulent and challenging yet exciting time for the city. I think she really provided him the emotional support he needed during an incredibly stressful time as mayor. A few stories from his time in office. I think the highlight, at least to me, would have to be his decision and you know, really showing a whole lot of courage to testify before Congress on behalf of the public accommodations bill, which kind of eventually made its way into the Civil Rights Act. And he was the only Southern elected official to do so. He had a good relationship with President Kennedy. And after receiving this request from him and really kind of discussing the decision at length with my grandmother and some friends, he decided to head to Washington in July of 1963 against the advice of many of his friends. It was just an incredibly difficult decision, and at the time it was a very risky political move. Even the senior black leaders, Martin Luther King Sr., feared that the testimony would hurt his reelection chances. And before and after, he received death threats by mail and phone calls to his house, and really lost more than a few close friends in the business community for that decision. But he went ahead, and he knew it was the right thing to do, and he gave his perspective, which he felt leading the largest Southern city would be helpful context for Congress to understand kind of the boots on the ground and what he was seeing and why it was absolutely critical to integrate and that there could not be any further delay. So he certainly did what was the right thing to do over what was most politically convenient. Another landmark, but intensely challenging moment in which Gary Pomerantz mentioned in an earlier podcast was the evening that my grandfather broke the news to Coretta Scott King that her husband had been killed in Memphis. And I know from family stories that this was really kind of one of the key, most haunting moments in his time as mayor. But there were certainly high points as well. And I think one of the really fun ones was bringing the Braves to Atlanta. In my mind, and I'm in the business world, and it's to me one of the great deal negotiations of all time. I'm trying to align the financing of a new stadium with barely a handshake deal in place, while simultaneously trying to get approval for Major League Baseball and the owners. This was all kind of coming together real time, and it was formulated on a hope and a prayer that the grand plan would work out, which of course it just barely did. But that was one of many, and hopefully that's some interesting tidbits there.
Bo, you mentioned Gary's book, obviously, and that's the occasion of which we're speaking right now. I wanted to get some perspective from you on how you felt reading your family's history in this book, in the way that it was laid out. I just feel like that's such an interesting perspective. And I guess, do you have any lasting impressions of where Peachtree meets Sweet Auburn?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was funny. My grandfather said, well, I don't think our family is that interesting. And, you know, that's probably true. But when you kind of put it all together, I certainly think it's interesting looking at kind of the two families side by side. They're completely distinct, you know, and separate, but at the same time related narratives about civic engagement. And I think that's really about, you know, it's a story about Atlanta itself. And it's just a collection of a very passionate, engaged people, of which several folks in my family, going back generations, happen to be a very small part of it. But it's certainly exciting and kind of one, you know, several chapters in the making of Atlanta. And I think the exciting part is that the story is still being written, and there are so many other kind of fascinating narratives unfolding today. And hopefully there will be many more books written about the progress that the city continues to make every day.
Well, lastly, but definitely not least, I really want to ask what may be the most unfair question, but maybe it's also a very easy question, and that is, what are you most proud of when it comes to your family?
Yeah, I think going back many, many generations, so many of us have had kind of had the love for the city of Atlanta and its advancement and all of its citizens as really a driving force in our lives. And I think so many of us have gone about this civic engagement. It's almost a calling of sorts in different ways and in different eras. My great grandfather, Hugh T. Enman, was a very active businessman around the turn of the last century. And in addition to his commercial activities, he was incredibly active in virtually every aspect of what was then a very small community, and served on the council for many years. My great grandfather, Ivan Sr., was an incredible champion for the city in the 1920s, leading the Ford Atlanta campaign, founding Atlanta Rotary, and serving as president of the Chamber of Commerce. My grandmother, Louise Richardson Allen, really dedicated so much of her time to cultural and civic activities, particularly the Atlanta History Center, and leading the charge on countless charitable fundraising campaigns. And Mayor Allen's three sons, I'm the third, Inman, and my dad, Bo, and their wives were also incredibly active, you know, from the 1970s onward in so many different organizations across the community. And my generation is I think doing our best to carry on this commitment today in a variety of our own ways and passions. It's quite a challenge to rise to the occasion, but something we are all committed to and excited about every day. So I think just that kind of common thread across generations of being incredibly passionate about the city and its advancements is something that I think is pretty cool and think about a lot.
Well, as we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts? I know that over the course of a conversation, sometimes things pop up into your head and, you know, you may want to slide some other thoughts in there or just want to revisit some things. But I definitely want to give you a chance to say anything that comes to your mind or that kind of popped up over the course of our chat, but just want to give you the space to do that in case there's a want to.
Yeah, I think this is just such a neat and kind of timely and timeless project to honor these two great men and their they had a great relationship between them, certainly in their later lives. It's just so exciting to kind of hear this be told in a variety of different formats to be as relevant today as ever. So just want to kind of thank you for bringing it to life and keeping it relevant. It's incredibly exciting.
In the previous episodes of the podcast, the goal was to help frame Atlanta's past through the perspectives of current voices and to show us how we can connect with that past as we move toward the future. And since the book centers on race and family, I'm so glad we have the opportunity to include some family perspectives as well. So, here's my conversation with Valerie Jackson.
Valerie Jackson, and I'm also known as Mrs. Maynard Jackson around town. I have another life also as Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a radio show on WABE that I host. As a matter of fact, I've been with WABE for over 20 years now and enjoy the work very much. So I've been looking forward to this conversation since I haven't been doing too many on my own because of the pandemic. So I'm back in the saddle again. And I'm also a partner in Jack Mott Hospitality, which is a food service company here in Atlanta, started by Maynard and his daughter and another gentleman, Daniel Halpern. So we are still hopefully going to come through this pandemic all right, because it is a restaurant business. And let's see, I'm a mother of two daughters, stepmother to three, and have a very full life.
This conversation is a bit of a look back, if you will, but also looking forward at the same time as it relates to Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, A Saga of Race and Family by Gary Pomerantz. And I guess, Ms. Jackson, how did you come to know of Maynard Jackson's love and commitment to Atlanta?
It wasn't difficult to see how much Atlanta meant to Maynard, because when we first met, that's about all he talked about. And when we were dating, Andy Young said to me, he said, you know, that this man has a mistress already. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, Atlanta. He said, Atlanta is his mistress, so be prepared to share him. And those were very wise words, in a way. And I didn't have any problem sharing Maynard with Atlanta, because I knew really that if he could love a city as strong and as devoted as he was, then that was really a natural extension of the way he was raised, his family values. Family was very important. Love was very important. You took care of your family. And Atlanta was Maynard's family. So the children, my two daughters who grew up with him, they were both born while he was mayor. We never worried about having to share him, because we knew it was a given that we would have to share this man, because so many people loved him because he loved them. And so much of his commitment to Atlanta stems from Maynard Jackson Sr., who was a minister, and John Wesley Dobbs. And both of them had strong core values about dignity and responsibilities. I think it was Grandpa Dobbs that started the saying, the book, the ballot, and the buck. These were the three elements that would be necessary for the Black race to survive and to prosper. The book, meaning education and the Bible, in many cases. The ballot, meaning the vote. John Wesley Dobbs was almost maniacal about getting people to register, Blacks to register to vote. And the buck being the last of the trilogy. And that stood for economic prosperity and opportunities. And that's really where Maynard started to fill in the equation. His father and his grandfather, through the ministries and through the political activities of John Wesley Dobbs, had brought the people through those first two stages, but they still didn't have access to that third leg, the buck, the economic opportunities that were available in Atlanta for all other citizens for the most part. So the values of John Wesley Dobbs and Maynard Jackson Sr. were born out of love for community and for family. Both of them were race men. They were very involved in the public for all, but they were especially keyed on being sure that the Black citizens received what they were deserving of.
So when you're around Atlanta these days, when you get a chance to visit different parts of the city, or even the region for that matter, what feels like the most visible reminder of Maynard's legacy as mayor to you?
You mean other than the airport, right?
Exactly, yes.
Because the airport would certainly be the most visible reminder of his legacy. But beyond that, but I'm going to go back to the airport in a second, but beyond that, with respect to the rest of the city and around the city, when I walk around Atlanta and I see the results of Maynard's affirmative action policies everywhere, I see Herman Russell's construction company and their participation in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium and the Georgia Dome. They worked on those projects. I see Dave Moody's design and construction company. He just last year or two built a new wing on the Atlanta History Center. And I see Blacks and women on Fortune 500 boards throughout the city, leading major corporations. And remember now, when Maynard became mayor, there was not one Black board member of a major company in Atlanta or in any bank. No Blacks on banks, corporate headquarters. And he went to the banks and he said to them, he warned them that if he wanted to keep the city's money in their banks, then they had to integrate their boards. They had to bring in some Black members to the board of directors. And of course, the first response was, oh, well, you know, we can't find qualified Blacks. They haven't been in this industry long enough, and so forth and so on. And so Maynard said to them, well, if you don't have any Blacks on your board, then I'll just have to take the city's money and put it in a bank in Birmingham or some other city that does have Black people on their bank boards, and we'll just handle it that way. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, they found some qualified Black board members. And so it reminds me of what Maynard says, you have to use what you've got to get what you need. And he had the power to say, Atlanta will pull that money out of your banks and put it in a bank that does have Black board members. He had that power. I see people like Stacey Abrams, who was greatly influenced by Maynard. I see her fighting the tough fight. She tells me the story about how she was demonstrating at City Hall when she was a student and was asking Maynard some very pointed questions, which impressed Maynard. And afterwards, he called her and he offered her a job as his student coordinator. And she's told me that it was her first political mentor. He was her first political mentor and is still her role model today.
But if it wasn't for Maynard, you know, setting an example, speaking truth to power, when blacks were still supposed to know what their place was, I see many young people interested in politics because they see what Maynard Jackson was able to do. And I see also when I walk around and go around the city, I see livable neighborhoods that are that stem really from his NPU, his neighborhood planning units that he created when he became mayor, to give voice to the people who lived in those neighborhoods with respect to the city planning their communities. For instance, you know, it gave them the power to block the highway that some people wanted to run through Inman Park about 35 years ago. But now the neighborhood units are strong. They can speak up against a stadium that's being built in their neighborhood if they didn't want it. Doesn't always mean they're going to succeed. But the point being, they had a voice, or each neighborhood has a voice that allows them to participate in Atlanta's future. So I really don't have to look very far to see the remnants, you know, of Maynard's legacy, if you will.
With that being said, and given all of the people who Maynard Jackson touched as mayor, and who all feel like they are a part of his legacy, do people still come up and tell you different stories about Maynard and how he influenced them? And if so, what are some of those stories like?
Just about every day, if I go out, someone might have a story that they tell me about Maynard. At least every day that I go out, someone speaks his name to me, which is wonderful because I believe there's power in the spoken word. And when you speak someone's name, you're calling up their essence and their vibrations. And I don't want to get too esoteric on right now, but I do believe that we can reach out and communicate in terms of spirit with those who've gone on before. There's an old Egyptian proverb that says that people will not be dead as long as you speak their name. And so the more I hear Maynard's name spoken, the happier I am, even though each time I hear it also is a ping in my heart because I miss him so much still after 17 years. But it's a kind of pain that is a joyful pain. I think my favorite story really is about when I was walking through the airport one day. And an elderly man ran up to me and said, "Miss Jackson, Miss Jackson." And so I stopped and turned around and he ran over to me and he says, "Miss Jackson, I just want to tell you what your husband did for us." He said, "Before Mayor Jackson, we were shoeshine boys. But Maynard Jackson made us business men." It just almost bowled me over because he was talking about a program that Maynard had instilled that helped to instruct applicants how to submit bids and proposals for the airport. And of course, you know, those men who worked on some of the shoeshine stands didn't have that kind of business acumen that they knew how to do all of these things. And so they were taken aside and shown how to do it. And they were taught how to develop a bid. And he was just so excited. The pride in his face moved me so deeply. I almost cried, but I just hugged him instead. But what this man gained was more than just a contract. He gained dignity. And I'm getting ready to cry just thinking about it. He was no longer a shoeshine boy, but a shoe service concessionaire. He was a man. But on a lighter note, one of the funnier stories about Maynard is when he first became mayor in his first term, he would hold what they would call an open house for Mayor's Day. And what this meant was that any citizen could come in and asked the mayor about anything that concerned him, the citizen. And one day, a very elderly Black woman came in and waited patiently for her turn. She sat down and waited so patiently. And when she was finally called into Maynard's office, Maynard, you know, kindly asked her, and what can I do for you, ma'am? What do you need? And she was looking him up and down. Finally, she said, oh, I don't want anything. I just wanted to see what a Black mayor looks like. And Maynard laughed and said, well, how do I look? And she smiled and said, you look good, real good. And so that's also one of my favorites. But there are so many others of people coming up to me saying that they got their start by working by getting a contract at the airport, or they had Maynard to mentor them in municipal bonds, which was his law specialty, and how he encouraged. As a matter of fact, he started a whole organization that was directed at bringing young minorities, young men and women, Black men and women, into the finance industry. Because when he was working in as a law partner in the financial industry for Chapman and Cutler after he left office, less than 1% of all the municipal bond business went to Black firms. And so he changed that. He created an organization that would expose young Blacks to the financial industry. And the interest in that industry grew tremendously in Black firms and among Black lawyers. In just about any part of the city, in any area of the city, whether it's the arts, because a lot of people got their start because Maynard funded the arts and established the Bureau of Cultural Affairs. And for the first time, Atlanta was exposed to public art. And the reason why public art is important is because when people feel that they are a part of something, that they have some ownership in something, they have a tendency to be more proud and prideful of it. And Atlanta has such a beautiful industry in the arts, and especially in the Black arts, National Black Arts Festival. All of these open doors to a whole different industry that Blacks before had been basically blocked out of. So I have the artists coming to me telling me how much Maynard taught the city about the importance of art and the spirit that art brings to a city.
Talk about Maynard on a personal note, in terms of the love that you all shared, and I guess the person that we all didn't get to see quite as often. So I would love for you to maybe give our listeners some sense of what love looked and felt like between you and Maynard.
I think really the best way that I can kind of tell it in a nutshell is tell about the monument that I built for him at Oakland Cemetery. Because that really was a labor of love, no pun intended. After Maynard died, a few months after he passed, I was at the cemetery just talking to him, which I did a lot of. And I was trying to decide what kind of monument or marker, rather, that I should put at his grave. And even though I had talked to a few firms or companies about designs, I really hadn't seen anything that had touched me. And so I was talking to him one day, and I was just saying, Maynard, I said, I don't know what to do for you, baby. I don't know what to build for you. I said, let your spirit guide me to somewhere, to some marker in this cemetery that might show me what you might like. And I said, because I don't know what you want. I don't know what to do for you. So I just started meandering and walking through Oakland Cemetery. I wasn't reading any grave sites or looking at anything in particular. I just walked, I just meandered until something caught my eye. And off several hundred yards away, well, maybe not 100 yards, but maybe 20 yards away, I saw two obelisks that were standing next to each other, about 6 feet tall, two obelisks that were connected, joined by a seat, by a marble seat or a granite seat. And so I said to myself, I said, oh, I said, is that what you want, Maynard? I said, that's interesting. And I said out loud, it does kind of look like a throne, because I would always kid with Maynard about, you know, his demeanor, you know, his royal and regal demeanor. And so I said, oh, it does look kind of like a king's throne. And so I started walking toward the monument. And the closer I got to it, the more I kept saying, Maynard, is this what you want me to do? And then as I got up on it, I realized that I was approaching it from the back. And as I walked around to the front of it, I was thinking again about how much I love this man and how I just wanted to do something special for him. And, you know, because we were such a romantic couple, Valentine's Day was our special day, especially since our first daughter was born on Valentine's Day. So Valentine's Day was very special in our life. And as I'm walking from behind this marker to approach it from the front, I was thinking of this love. And as I got around to the front, the first thing that jumped out at me was an inscription on the bench that connected the two obelisks. And the inscription said, all I ask of you is forever to remember me as loving you. And I looked down, and the name on the monument was Valentine. And I said, oh my gosh, I knew it had to be a message from Maynard. And I said to him, I said, oh my God, baby, just for that, saying that I don't have to do anything for you, I'm going to build you something really big. And so I did. I built him a 14-foot, 14-ton, honed black granite monument, personally designed by me and my brother, who is a visual artist. And it was truly a labor of love. Now, it took me 10 years to get to that point from the time I asked him what to do for him, because I was still very much in denial. I still didn't want to believe that he was gone. And as long as I didn't have a marker up, and I guess in my mind I was thinking if I didn't acknowledge it, then it wasn't true. So for 10 years, I guess refused to face reality, but I finally did. And then it took me 3 years to design the monument and to have it made and erected. But that's the kind of love we had, that went beyond the grave. And to this day, whenever I find a penny, I believe it's a sign from him. And I have a tall jar, a collection of my Maynard pennies that I have found throughout the years.
You share his legacy with millions of other people. And we all, those of us who grow up in Atlanta or live in Atlanta, are in connection with that legacy in many different ways. But as someone who is charged with caretaking or taking care of that legacy or maintaining that legacy forward, what are the things that are most important to you as you carry Maynard's legacy forward?
One of the most difficult things to do is to keep his legacy accurate and alive, if you will. For instance, one of the biggest challenges that I still have today is the Atlanta Journal-Constitution dropping the name Jackson off of Hartsfield Jackson. Now, for the first couple of years, I had to call the TV stations and remind them constantly that it was no longer Hartsfield International Airport, it was Hartsfield Jackson International Airport. And it was extremely important, not just because his administration built the airport, but because he asked me a couple of years before he passed, I asked him, I said, Maynard, what do you want your legacy to be in Atlanta? How do you want people to remember you? And he said, I want my name on the airport. And I promised him that day that his name would go on that airport. I didn't know then how or when or where, but I knew as long as I was alive that his name was going to be on its way to that airport. Anyway, so like I said, it took me a couple of years to get the TV stations to remember to ask Jackson. But 17 years, I've written over a dozen letters to the editors of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about dropping Maynard from the airport's name. And even just several months ago, a headline read, Hartsfield, it said, airline memorabilia comes to Hartsfield. No mention of Jackson. And we're talking 6 or 7 months ago. It's not like they haven't learned yet the name. It's not like I haven't written them time and time again about it. So it's hard to still be trying to educate and correct, but it has to go on. And I take my hat off to Mrs. Coretta Scott King. I look at what all she must have had to do to keep Martin Luther King's name alive and to have that holiday named after him. Anyway, keeping his legacy alive, it's a hard job, but it's an easy one at the same time because he deserves it. The city deserves it. And needs to be reminded and should be reminded of those people who changed this city for the better.
Thank you to Valerie Jackson. Thank you to Bo Allen. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Atlanta Legacy Makers podcast, and I hope you have enjoyed the book, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn. Now that we've come to the end of the book, there's only one thing left to do, read it again. Why not? Until then, I'm Floyd Hall, and forever, I love Atlanta. Atlanta Legacy Makers is an initiative led by Central Atlanta Progress and the City of Atlanta. Special thanks to author Gary M. Pomerantz, lecturer at Stanford University in the graduate program in journalism. We heard Gary at the very beginning of this episode talking about some of the backstory of writing Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn. And we're thankful and thrilled to have Gary's perspective throughout this project. Special thanks to our amazing partners, Atlanta Downtown Improvement District, Atlanta Public Schools, Constellations, Gene Kansas Commercial Real Estate, the Ivan Allen College of Liberal Arts at Georgia Tech, One Atlanta, and Supporter Report. Atlanta Legacy Makers is hosted and produced by Floyd Hall. That's me. Music by Smith & Cash. Last but not least, thank you, Atlanta.